Unreal. Uncensored. Unradio.
CliffCentral.com.
All right, it's a little after 1 o'clock with me, Mabale Moloi, and it's time to shift gears, thanks to Chiro and the Motoring Show. But now we're going to get into the top news stories from the day and also the stories that have been making headlines throughout the week. It's part of the Daily Maverick edition, which we do here on Cliff Central. And to help me do so this afternoon, I'm joined by Simon Allison and Richard Poplack from the Daily Maverick. Gentlemen, good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Good afternoon.
Thanks again for joining us in studio. I think, Richard, you might have to lean in a little bit closer to that mic here. Okay, so let's begin with news happening on the continent, and we'll begin with Egypt. Egypt, of course, they announced a one-day extension of voting in the country's presidential election on Tuesday. This is after they discovered that there was a very low voter turnout in that election process. Provisional election results show that Abdel Fattah al-Sisi, the general who toppled Egypt's first democratically elected leader, won by a convincing 94%.
Isn't democracy beautiful? Hey?
That one-day extension should help make this free and fair.
This is the true example of democracy at play here. But the important question is this low voter turnout a surprise?
It shouldn't be.
No. I think there's almost... Listen, I mean, and first of all, the country is split right down the middle. Although I'd say it's weighted more towards people who would back the Muslim Brotherhood, who, of course, have been banned, thrown in jail, hung, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So at least 50 to 60% of the country sees no point in throwing their hat into the ring on these elections. So, no, that voter turnout, to my mind, is perfectly natural.
No, I agree. But although I would disagree with you there, I don't think that the Muslim Brotherhood or the sort of Islamist factions have a majority of support in the country. Mm. And I think that's always been their problem. They have a good sort of 30-40%. But the bulk of Egyptians, I don't think, are that particularly motivated. You know, when you look at Tahrir Square, the revolution of 2011, you have these million-man marches in Tahrir Square. Amazing, incredible things. But that's a million people on the streets. And I think the population, it's 55-something million.
No, it's about 80.
It's about 80. Yeah, so there's a million people on the street, so there's 79 million people staying at home.
Yeah.
There's still a lot of people who didn't buy into the revolution. They didn't buy into to the elections that followed. And what they really want is stability. They want a bit of peace and quiet returning to their lives, and they think that another general in the mold of Hosni Mubarak can give that to them.
Well, speaking of wanting peace and quiet, this is one of the reasons that was cited by observers. They were saying that, well, of course Egyptians are not going to come out to vote. They're tired. They've just been through a tumultuous process. They've ousted a leader. Really, they just want some peace and quiet. But how do they do that if they don't go to the polls?
Well, I think you're right that they are tired, because protesting is tiring. Voting is tiring. Waiting in queues is tiring. And they've been doing this for 3 years.
Mm.
I wouldn't want to be, you know, I want to stay at home for a little bit and watch TV.
Yeah, I also think... You know, I do return to the theme, though, that I don't think there's any legitimacy towards these elections, and I think Egyptians know that. I mean, listen, with regard to the sort of broad-based support for the revolution in the way that we understand it, the narrative that was sort of perpetuated, there's 60 million Egyptians outside of Cairo, many of whom live in rural areas, and their thinking is very different from their urbanized counterparts. And I do think they largely bought into the Muslim Brotherhood end of the stick, the Islamist end of the stick. And, you know, to them, this just probably seems like a return to the same.
Well, al-Sisi made a very public declaration. He said he wanted a high turnout. He wanted at least 80% of the population to turn out to vote. He wanted this turnout because he wanted it to prove to supporters of the Muslim Brotherhood, to people in Egypt and the rest of the world, that he is the popular guy.
Yeah, and I want a Porsche 911 Turbo.
But yeah. I mean, this low turnout, yeah, which is below 50%, should this be sending alarm bells at al-Sisi? What should he make of this?
I think he'll be concerned, but not that concerned. He is firmly in charge. He's got the backing of international governments. America are a lot more amenable towards his policies than they were towards the Muslim Brotherhood.
Mm-hmm.
And he really does have control of the institutions of state. He has control of the army, of the police, of the vast bureaucracies which sort of define Egyptian public life. Hosni Mubarak created this amazing sort of web of patronage. So he would, you know, he'd pay off the police chief, and the police chief would pay off the little underlings, and the underlings would pay off people. This web of sort of money and favors that all came down to Hosni Mubarak's control. That web still exists. And that was one of the big problems the Muslim Brotherhood had. They came into power, and the civil service, the bureaucracy, wouldn't listen to them. They would, you know, the president would make an order, no one would follow through on it, because they didn't like him. They didn't want to do what he did. Whereas Sisi, he's part of that network. He's now taken over Mubarak's patronage network, and he can make things happen in that bureaucracy, and that's really what controls Egypt. Control them, you've got the country sorted.
Well, what happened is, because there was such a low turnout, the voter commission decided to extend the elections, which of course then some people had a problem with this, especially the observers. They said, well, you're tipping the scale in al-Sisi's favor. I mean, you are encouraging these people to come out and to vote for him. That's why you're extending the process. So what do you make of that?
Well, yeah, I mean, they're right.
Exactly.
You know, the whole thing is just is complete farce. And so, it's sort of bound to meet with all of this controversy. I don't think anybody is fooling themselves into thinking these were free and fair elections that represent the needs and wants of the bulk of Egyptians.
It was predicted that it was going to be a long road for Egypt after they ousted their last leader. But the question is, how much longer is it going to take for this country to rebuild itself, and certainly for the country to want to go to the polls?
Oh man, it's in trouble. It's in really, really big trouble.
And what does that mean for their future?
The economy is just pretty much collapsed. It was heavily, heavily reliant on tourism. Tourists haven't been going to Egypt in large numbers over the last couple of years. You know, it's suddenly not such an attractive destination. So that's in trouble. The knock-on effect of that is it affects services and businesses. It's just everything. The tourism is so central. More than that, though, Egypt has a few sort of really structural problems that it can't escape from. One is just the way it's set up. So I think 90% of Egyptians live on 5% of the land. And it's all this narrow band of lovely, lush fertility along the Nile. Outside of that, it's just desert. And no one lives there. Problem is, so much population, there's not enough water for the crops, for the people. There's a huge water shortage that is in Egypt's near future. Someone's got to sort that out. And another problem is Ethiopia, which is upstream on the Nile. They're putting a huge dam. They're building it right now because they want to tap some of that hydroelectric power. And that is also going to create even more water shortages over the next few years. So they have just a few huge problems that someone's got to tackle.
And speaking of their future, another thing that was painfully obvious was that the youth were not interested in being part of the election process at all. But, you know, the youth are going to keep the country going if you have to rely on them to vote. So they've
I think Egypt's young, especially their young sort of revolutionaries, the bloggers, the educated kids, they understand that the revolution failed, that they're back at square one. And while it isn't outrageous to think that a junta of the kind that al-Sisi is operating can at some point lead to a democratic future, right now they aren't seeing any of those dividends. And, you can't really blame them. Why would you go to the polls in a farce like what's happened there over the past couple of days?
It's not a phenomenon restricted to Egypt, though, the fact that the youth are apathetic. We see it here.
Yeah.
We certainly see it in the States and the UK. I think that there's this idea that young people sort of haven't necessarily bought into this whole thing that elections are the future and democracy is the way. They sort of see this as it's just more of the same, and they're not necessarily content to be part of that process.
If you're a slightly radical young person voting here, voting in Egypt, voting in the States, you know, your first question is going to be why?
Yeah.
Doesn't make a difference.
No. And I think if anything, that should cause the elders to pay attention to the fact that we cannot be patronized the way that they used to, and we are in fact interested in the future of our countries.
Yeah, you're absolutely right.
Okay, well then on to another story. This one coming out of the United States. Edward Snowden, I don't know if you guys caught a bit of his interview that he did with NBC. Well, he has claimed to have been a government-trained spy whose expertise has been systematically downplayed by the establishment. He's quoted saying, they're trying to use one position that I've had in a career here or there to distract from the totality of my experience. Let me play you a clip of a bit of that interview that Edward Snowden did on NBC.
Well, it's no secret that the U.S. tends to get more and better intelligence out of computers nowadays than they do out of people. I was trained as a spy in sort of the traditional sense of the word, in that I lived and worked undercover overseas, pretending to work in a job that I'm not, and even being assigned a name that was not mine. Now, the government might deny these things. They might frame it in certain ways and say, oh, well, you know, he's a low-level analyst. But what they're trying to do is they're trying to use one position that I've had in a career here or there to distract from the totality of my experience, which is that I've worked for the Central Intelligence Agency undercover overseas. I've worked for the National Security Agency undercover overseas. And I've worked for the Defense Intelligence Agency as a lecturer at the Joint Counterintelligence Training Academy, where I developed sources and methods for keeping our information and people secure in the most hostile and dangerous environments around the world.
What I liked about what Brian Williams said, who conducted that that interview on NBC, he said, oh, so evidently spies look like you, Edward Snowden. They don't look like James Bond, for example, which I thought, because, you know, he's a small, unassuming guy.
So I think there's hope for all of us.
I think that's the message.
You know, my James Bond career hasn't been canceled. That's great.
But this guy, you know, he's accused of espionage by his native USA. He's marooned in Moscow. He's basically a man without a home. No country wants him.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's what happens when you release the biggest cache of information in history.
That's what happens when you upset the US, I suppose.
Yeah. And
superpowers.
I mean, yeah. That's you know, dumping over a really big apple cart. So, yeah, I mean, it's not surprising that he's sort of in the situation that he's in. Yeah, marooned in Moscow is a great way of putting it.
That's, you know, well, how would you put it?
No,
Richard?
No, you're right. I mean, he's marooned in Moscow. It sounds like a Woody Allen film.
Yeah. I'd watch that.
Yeah.
You were going to say, Simon?
No, I just think it is interesting that he's saying that the U.S. is downplaying his experience and his role. And of course, they would do that. They don't want to acknowledge that someone important, someone who they'd, you know, spent a lot of time and money on, had actually turned out to not do what they wanted, really.
Yeah.
Having said that, it's impossible to know. You know, is he inflating his own sense of importance? I reckon not, because he had access to that level of documentation, and he had to have been semi-high up in the hierarchy to do so.
I think the part of the story that I'm missing is what difference it makes, in the sense that he will be remembered as one of the great whistleblowers of all time. I mean, the information he's released into the world has literally changed the way we see the world. Change the way we think, and change the way we act and how we live. Does it matter whether he was, you know, the sort of head custodial janitor or that he was a high-level James Bond type spy? That, I mean, to me personally, it doesn't really matter. The quality of the information he's released is self-evident.
Okay. Well, let's listen to Secretary of State John Kerry's response, because they asked him for a reaction, and this is what he had to say.
Well, the United States, through various agencies, is reaching out to lots of countries in an effort to try to secure Mr. Snowden. He needs to come back to America and face the justice system based on the choices that he's made. What I see is an individual who threatened his country and put Americans at risk through the acts that he took. People may die as a consequence of what this man did. It is possible the United States will be attacked because terrorists may now know how to protect themselves in some way or another that they didn't know before.
In true American style, the reaction is a bit dramatic. You know, Americans may die. We will suffer under terrorism attacks.
Americans die because of what John Kerry does every single day. I mean, that argument is completely... I mean, you know, Americans die because of Coca-Cola. I think what the establishment in America is trying very, very hard to do is to try swing the sort of moral end of this equation towards Mr. Snowden. It's very, very clear that the information that he released implicates the Obama administration and the administrations that came before it in a vast, totally illegal, completely immoral system of spying, A, on its own citizens, and B, on the people in the rest of the world.
Now, Richard, you mentioned earlier that the Snowden revelations have changed the way we see the world. That's true.
Mm-hmm.
And you also said they've changed the way that we sort of behave in it. Do you think we've changed enough? I know personally, I'm still using Google. I'm still using Skype. I haven't changed my behavior particularly, even though I know these things. Should we be doing more to almost hide our private lives from agencies that could find them?
Well, you know, I've said on the show before, there's no such thing as privacy. It doesn't exist. That said, I think we now know when we send an email, when I send something out of my iPhone, I send it off, I have no illusions that it can't be intercepted by this government, the one here, the one that essentially we work in opposition to as South African journalists, and certainly by the Americans and by the Russians and by the Turkish, and I don't know who else. I have no illusions whatsoever that a piece of correspondence that I send off, a WhatsApp message, anything, can be intercepted by somebody who may or may not be interested.
And also, what more could we possibly do to protect ourselves? I mean, I know that if I go into Google and search Al-Qaeda, that I'm automatically a suspect to some, you know, American somewhere thinking, well, I'm monitoring all the Al-Qaeda-related searches on Google. We know that our governments are monitoring us through our phones, through our web searches. We know that they keep secrets from us as well. What much more could we possibly do?
And we want to be clear, you're the one searching Al-Qaeda. We have nothing to do with this whatsoever.
You had to distance yourself from that immediately.
See, on that topic, though, I mean, my job is researching these kind of things. I'm searching crazy stuff all the time, and I'm very worried. If somebody picked up my search history, there'd be some really dodgy things on there.
This is
true. I bet there would be some. that's for another radio show.
Okay. Now, Simon, you've been working on a story out of Guinea, which involves the president of Guinea signing a new multi-billion dollar iron ore deal with Anglo-Australian mining company Rio Tinto. Just give us a background to the story. What exactly is this deal? How did it come about? What does it mean for the future of Guinea?
This is a really fascinating story. It's worthy of a Hollywood script. Last year, a journalist for The New Yorker, Patrick Radden Keefe, wrote a really fantastic piece explaining how this... It was an Israeli billionaire who'd come into Guinea. Guinea's a little West African country, very poor, but Guinea sits on top of the world's largest untapped reserves of iron ore. Iron ore is what you use to make aluminium. So it's obviously a very important resource in the modern world, and it's just sitting there. It's sitting in these mountains, huge amounts of it, and it's also some of the purest in the world, so it doesn't require much in the way of processing. Now, this Israeli billionaire comes in, and he wants an exploration license. He wants to start mining this iron ore. And he manages to pick it up in exchange for a couple of hundred million US dollars in investment into Guinea. I mean, we're not talking big money. In the mining world, a few hundred million dollars is peanuts.
Mm-hmm.
The potential revenues from this, we're talking tens of billions of dollars. So he manages to pick up this license. Within a year, he's sold half of his license to a Brazilian miner for, I think it was, $2.5 billion.
Okay, so he made a good profit.
So he made a very tidy profit, and he's still holding on to half of his thing. Now, you look at this at first, and you're like, well, you can't blame him. He's a businessman. He went and he did a deal. It's not his fault that the government really messed up and gave him a far undervalued price. But what this New Yorker journalist did is he dug a little deeper, and basically there's all kinds of corrupt dealings going on, you know, diamond-encrusted watches, bags of money being distributed to various leaders of the country to ensure that he got this deal. So basically, he bribed his way, his company bribed his way into this deal and made a fortune off the back of it. What's happened now is there was a coup in Guinea, and then the military coup leader got killed, and after that there were elections, and a new guy was put in power, President Alpha Conde. And one of the first things he did was to review the finances, review the contracts and tenders that had been given out. And he saw this deal, and he just thought, no, this is wrong. This is crazy. This money, this billions and billions of dollars, is going into the shareholders of this strange Israeli prospecting company and not into the Guinean people. And yes, the businesses will argue that, no, once a deal has been signed, it's been signed, it's finished. But if it has been signed in bad faith, if it's been signed as a result of corrupt practices, it doesn't necessarily stand. And this is what Guinea said. So they scrapped the deal. After a few months of investigating, they said, no, we're not going to be bound by this corrupt deal. We're going to sell the shares again.
And what have been the legal repercussions of scrapping that deal? Because contracts have been signed, as you mentioned.
Well, the BSRG, the Israeli company, is suing them in the International Court of Arbitration. At least they say that's what they're doing. They haven't actually gone followed through with a suit, and it's been about 6 weeks. So you sort of wonder if they're just, you know, talking the talk. They've got a problem because the Brazilian miner that bought $2.5 billion worth of shares is now not too happy because they've been sold a dud. And if indeed it was corrupt, then they're not really responsible, and there might be grounds for getting their money back. But now what's happened is the Ghanaian government has reissued this prospecting license for the iron ore for an investment in return for an investment of about $20 billion. So that is 100 times the amount of the original thing was sold for. So imagine you pick up a car that's worth 500,000 for 5,000 rand. That's what we're talking about here. So it really is huge sums.
Sure, on the surface, it looks like foreign shareholders are coming into the African continent. They're extracting minerals. They leave with the bulk of the money and leave us with very little. But at the same time, you do get those African leaders who can be corrupted, who instead of looking out for the interests of the country, they will take a little cut, and they are perfectly happy with that.
Yeah, but I think it takes two to tango. Yeah. And that's the really, really important thing about the story, is that you had a corrupt African leader, you met a corrupt business person, they did a deal. Now, what's interesting is that fate, or whatever you want to call it, intervenes. The gentleman, I think he took a bullet to the head, correct?
He did.
Yeah. Ah,
terrible. He was the second one. Yeah. The first one died, then the second one got a bullet to the head.
So these are, you know, couldn't have happened to a nicer guy, I guess. And you end up with the country in the hands of a very enlightened man. And this is, it's Alpha Conde. Yeah.
So what new precedents is this going to set, if any? Are there going to be implications for future business dealings? Are there other African leaders going to be looking at the president of Guinea going, well,
yes,
he has the game changer?
Yes.
Yes.
I think the implications, especially in smaller West African nations, are massive. They can't be underestimated. The company who's mostly got screwed over, this is the Brazilian company Vale, is a major, major, major mining player. So the chances for precedent-changing best practices in buying major concessions like this one are absolutely going to be reformed. I personally think the Barry Steinmetz deal was the end of an era for Africa.
Do you think this is going to scare away those foreign shareholders who do prefer to do corrupt business? Are they all of a sudden going to be looking at the African continent going, oh no, they're wisening up. Now we can't get away with as much anymore. What's that going to do?
You know, I think that Africa will be interesting to all kinds of businesses, regardless of this change in precedent, because there is still money to be made. There's plenty of legitimate money to be made. Mm. And that is what we need to focus on, is that we're not going to scare away investors because we're not doing corrupt deals anymore. We're going to scare away investors with wars and sudden changes of laws and this kind of thing. But if you deal with businesses fairly and legitimately, negotiate a good deal for yourself, that'll be respected, and that'll be a win-win for everyone.
Richard, I want to touch on the potential benefits that this deal and doing a clean bill could have on the mining sector as a whole for Guinea, and then bringing back to South Africa, because we are still dealing with a bad situation with the mining strikes. Economists have now said, you know, if this goes on for any longer, we are going to officially be in a recession. And you called it, actually, a few weeks ago. You made reference to the situation that happened in Canada. Mm-hmm. So let's bring this back home and apply it to South Africa and the potential benefits for the mining,
sure,
for the mining sector.
Yeah, sure. Now listen, I think the precedent that Guinea sets is much more for smaller, let's say less sophisticated regulatory environments in Africa. I don't think there's much of a corollary with a country like South Africa, which is a very, very progressive mining charter. It has a very, very strict regulatory framework. And, you know, of course, while we understand that lots of corruption happens in this country, your leeway is not massive. But we'll get back to the South African situation in a moment. What I think is precedent setting for a situation like Guinea is that it puts mining companies on notice that they need to sit down and deal with government in a very, very real way in terms of understanding the mining charters, and most African countries have mining. I mean, the DRC, the Democratic Republic of the Congo, has quite a progressive mining charter. Now, they're switching some laws currently. Mining companies need to know that dealing with the dictator of the day is not going to be enough.
Mm-hmm.
Right? And when that happens, we will start to see a massive sort of downslide in the amount of corruption that goes on. We're never going to eliminate corruption from the mining sector. That's not what we're talking about here. But what we are talking about is a major, major sector of the African economy cleaning up in a very real way.
How soon logistically could we start seeing that slide that Richard is talking about, Simon, in getting rid of corruption and then conducting clean business?
Look, it's a slow process.
Yeah.
But I just think that, as Richard's been saying, that this will, I think it will inspire other governments to just review the tenders and the contracts and the things that they've issued in the light of the fact that they know they could make a better deal. And that's a good thing. That does take time, though. We're looking at a few years.
Oh, sure. But look, you know, the interesting thing about the Guinea concession is that it was so massive that it needed a major player to come in and start setting the concession up. I mean, mining iron ore is, it's an ancient business, but it's very, very sophisticated these days if you want to maximize your profits. So they bring in a company like Vale. Now, Vale is, again, it's a massive corporation. They have stakeholders. These stakeholders now need to understand from management why $2.5 billion has gone missing.
Mm.
And that has major precedent setting. I mean, we're talking about a $2.5 billion hole that is currently happening in the mining industry.
Yeah.
And people have to, you know, stakeholders are like, whoa, what?
Mm.
No, this can't happen again.
And what, if any, has been the response to this latest move by the president of Guinea? Has he been applauded by some of the African leaders? Do we know if people are talking about him as yet?
It's been pretty quiet, actually. There hasn't been much in the news except for a few sort of wire reports. I think that people are waiting to see what's going to happen in the International Court of Arbitration if the Israeli company does follow through with their claim and how that's handled as well.
Okay.
Yeah, I mean to be clear, African companies, when there's changes in administrations or regimes in African countries, these kind of things happen all the time. This is by no means an unprecedented situation in the fact, of a concession switching hands post the death of a dictator, and you know, then the entrance of another dictator who has to take care of his friends. But this seems to be a little bit different in the sense that it looks a lot cleaner.
All right, you're with Cliff Central. I'm joined by Simon and Richard from the Daily Maverick. This is the Daily Maverick News Edition on Cliff Central. Again, if you'd like to participate in the conversation, please do give us a call, 0861-555-189. Now, let's bring the news stories closer to home. In fact, let's take it to Stellenbosch, where Chief Justice Mokgweng Mokgweng spoke at the second annual African Law and Religion Conference at the University of Stellenbosch. This happened on Tuesday night. And he's decried the levels of maladministration, crime, and corruption, and the dishonesty that's permeated our facets of society. He's argued that religion should play a bigger role in lawmaking processes. Richard, what are the foreseeable problems with the Chief Justice's argument? I see you've already got a smile on your face.
The foreseeable problem. This guy has just been a nightmare from the get go. From being a petty apartheid administrator to being the Chief Justice of this country, his arc is the Zuma administration in its essence.
Mm-hmm.
The way I see this guy. He loves authority in any way, shape, or form. And you know, God is quite an enormous authority figure. So here we go.
Do you think he suffers from a bit of a God complex himself? Do you think they might
well,
be?
You know what? I think let's be fair. He's a devout man.
Mm.
He's a very, very devoted Christian. And a loony. and I don't think the three things are necessarily connected. There are lots of devout Christians who aren't loony,
right?
And who understand that their faith that at the basis of their faith are the teaching of a man who preached humility above all.
Well, let's Let's listen to a bit of what the Honorable Chief Justice Mokgoi
Brace yourself,
had to
listeners.
Say. Okay, let's
Brace
go.
Yourself.
It does not and should never matter how strongly opposed you are to the existence of a particular religion. All genuine religions, and I say genuine advisedly because if your religion propagates the killing of other human beings, as Professor Koopman indicated earlier on, that is not the kind of religion to be promoted on any platform, because human life is a fundamental right.
Human life is a fundamental right, but this is already the first problem that I see. He gets to distinguish a genuine religion from then what are the rest of the other religions that he doesn't think are genuine? What do we call them?
I get the sense he has not read the Old Testament.
Yeah, he seems to have skipped that one over. I mean, all through his speech, which I've read quite carefully, he's a highly trained, highly experienced legal professional. And, you know, that doesn't make him a good one, but he is highly experienced. He has a on this hand and an on that hand argument. Now, on this hand, basically what he says throughout the speech is that, you know, there are lots of things wrong with religion.
Mm.
But on the other hand, my personal religious practice, which is whatever stream of Christianity that he does practice, is the right one to sort of mix into the great recipe of the South African Constitution. And, you know, as much God as we can possibly get in there, we should get in there because religion is morality and morality is what we need.
But the problem is that religion is already such a sensitive topic. You know, it has so many principles and belief systems floating around depending on which religion you subscribe to. Some of these principles are contradictory to each other. It just sounds to me like we could possibly be making more work for ourselves if we were to listen to what the Chief Justice is suggesting. Why does he not see that?
Well, I mean, you know, this is it. It gets people so wound up because it's so completely irrational. Now, there are a couple of things I'd like to point out here. Christianity is not native to this country by any means. It doesn't have some sort of cultural, hierarchical standing over dozens of other faiths, some of them animist, some of them Christian,
yeah,
some of them, you know, completely different.
Mm-hmm.
So there's no real, the Chief Justice time and time again sort of stretches his type of Christianity
as
the one that should provide us with the moral standing that we need in order to stop fornication, stop adultery, stop killing each other, all of these other things. So he's identified in his own church a stream of Christianity which he feels would be the best one for us to practice within the bounds of our Constitution.
In fact, let's listen to him touching on adultery and divorce.
Oh boy.
A legal framework that frowns upon adultery, fornication, separation, and divorce, subject to appropriate modification, would, idealistic as this may appear to be, help us curb the murders that flow from adultery, as I indicated earlier, help us reduce the number of broken families and the consequential lost and bitter generation that seems to be on the rise, which in turn cause untold harm to society.
Simon, a legal system that frowns on divorce, what exactly would that entail? Would it mean that if Duncan and I got married and then we got sick of each other 10 years down the line and we both wanted to get a divorce, would it mean that the law would say no? You're going to remain miserable for the rest of your lives. What does that even mean?
I think the law would, in that scenario, it would just make it much more difficult to get divorced.
You have to really
hate each other.
Who is the Chief Justice of this country to tell me that I can't shag my neighbor's wife? I mean, that's just unbelievable. What happens between consenting adults, be it marriage or divorce or any other form of consensual hookup, is simply not within the bounds of sort of legal eyeballing.
Yeah.
But the crazy thing is South Africa realized this when we wrote our constitution. We did deliberately put in there that we're not going to use religion, any religion, as our moral compass. We're going to use the Bill of Rights and the things we put in our constitution to guide our decision making. And that's what it should be. That is a sort of a universal framework that everyone can agree on,
mm-hmm.
as opposed to these sort of chaotic religions that each denomination has a different take and a different... Where's it going to stop if we try and incorporate all that?
What our constitution does so well is say, listen, you want to practice religion? That's awesome. See you later.
Yeah.
Don't hurt anyone.
Yeah.
Don't burn anything down.
It's your business.
It's your business.
I'm not going to interfere with your business.
Yeah. And the other thing is, if you don't want to practice a religion, that's cool too. Don't hurt anyone. Don't burn anything down.
Right.
Have a nice day.
Okay.
Right. So that's enshrined in our constitution, which is an enormously progressive document. And should we as a nation sort of adhere to the legal frameworks within it, we're going to be just fine.
Okay. Well, one last word from the Chief Justice.
Theft is the semen that breeds fraud and corruption. The Bible forbids it, and so does our common law. As in the case of all other prohibitions, the question that does not always seem to receive adequate attention is, what systems do we establish and what widespread habits do we cultivate to eradicate the causes of theft, fraud, and corruption?
The irony that I find with the Chief Justice talking about how religion would solve all our problems with corruption is that we're currently dealing with possibly one of the most corrupt governments of our time right now in South Africa. But he almost sounds a bit like a pastor there for me.
He's a lay pastor. Yeah, he is. So, you know, that in itself is sort of, you know, whatever you do in your spare time. Again, the Constitution allows for him, you know, to go kite flying or skiing in the Alps or to be a lay pastor. That's fine. I just love that line. I'm going to get it tattooed on my back.
I think it could easily become a meme.
Semen is the fraud of society.
Richard, you mentioned that our constitution is very progressive, which it is. Now, let's take that and compare it to governments that are either anti-religion or completely religious governments. For example, China, anti-religious government. Mm-hmm. Does that make it a better or worse government than a completely religious government in a country like Iran, for example? Is one better than the other, or is it not as simple as that?
Well, look, it's never as simple as that. But I've got to tell you, I wouldn't want to live in Iran, and I wouldn't want to live in China.
Why not?
Because, you know, both of those governments are autocratic in their own way. And as far as I'm concerned, if I am to realize myself fully as a human being, it needs to be under a rubric of legislation the likes of which our constitution produces. So, you know, there's no ways I'm going to ship out to Iran because, hey, you know, at least this is a good religious joint where they stone people to death for fornicating. You know, there, semen is the fraud of corruption.
Yeah.
You know, yeah. And in China, you have the opposite. You have a situation in which, you know, fully realizing yourself as a human being, should you wish to do so through spiritual means, is frowned upon and in some cases completely forbidden.
Yeah.
Now that to me doesn't sound like anything I'd wanted to live through either.
And I do wonder if there's an argument you can make that China, sure, it's not a religion with a god, but the communist doctrine that it preaches is such a powerful.
But power always becomes a god where there's a vacuum like that.
Exactly.
So yeah, you're
so it's a religion without a deity, but it's still a religion, and it drives the same sort of cultish following that other religions have.
Yeah. All right. Well, President Jacob Zuma received some bad news not too long ago, you know, when the economists were saying to him, South Africa is headed for a recession. Mm-hmm. He's just announced his new cabinet. The Minister of Finance seemingly is going to have a whole lot more on his plate than anybody else because our economic situation is in dire straits. Richard, what do you make of our new cabinet? I feel like we should play a game of, I don't know, name your cabinet minister or how to remember your new cabinet minister or something similar to that.
Well, in the context of this conversation, Klantla Nene is the, obviously the new Minister of Finance.
Yes.
Very cruelly, he's been dubbed the first African Minister of Finance, Black African Minister of Finance. I think that's been an enormous insult to Trevor Manuel, who certainly didn't conceive himself as a white.
No.
African Minister of Finance. Nene is capable. The systems within that are in place within the finance ministry are functional. But, you know, what you have in this country is a complete breakdown in the triangulation between labor, government, and the private sector.
Right.
So in other words, it's a complete gong show. Nothing interesting or progressive can really happen at this stage because the entire situation is broken down.
But Richard, are our ministers, or are some of them qualified for the positions that they've now been placed in?
No, many are not. Many are, but many are not.
All right, I'm just having a look at our WeChat messages now, and some LZ Fosler is just asking a question or making a comment, and she says, which Christian denomination do you suggest they use? Richard, I think it's because you were referring to Christianity not being, you know, having been brought onto the continent. There are over 29,000 Christian denominations to choose from. Why not just use love as a base? Yeah, sure, in a perfect world with sunflowers and butterflies, I suppose. Because you would not kill if you love. The Ten Commandments were not meant to be laws, but an example of what love really is.
Hey, listen, LZ Forslu is right on the money. And, you know, I completely agree with her. I'm not suggesting that they use any Christian denomination, Jewish denomination, Islamic denomination, any other denomination. We have a constitution.
Yeah.
And our constitution is based on thousands of years of precedent. It's a legal document that we didn't just write, that the framers didn't just come up with.
Right.
I mean, there's lots and lots of precedent for it. And of course, so much Judeo-Christian thinking, philosophy, and best practice was baked into our constitution. There's lots of religion in there, if that's what you really want. I'm not saying anything in that constitution right now needs to be tweaked.
But also, LZ, not everybody is religious. Not everybody practices any kind of religion. So then what do you say to those people, Simon?
I say love is the semen of peace and democracy.
I love that. Yeah, yeah.
Okay. So, Richard, we were talking about the cabinet ministers and the fact that most of them not qualified for their job. Again, you know, it's just another case of the president rewarding his strongest allies.
100%. Listen, you have a cabinet that's 71 members strong. Now, that's one of the largest cabinets, I believe, anywhere on earth. I heard a statistic that I think if the cabinets of the United States, the United Kingdom, and Germany are not combined, don't have 71 ministers.
Why do we need so many ministers?
Because, as you mentioned, this is sheer factionalism. It's Jacob Zuma paying off his cronies and ensuring that his power base is in check. It's very, very lucrative being a minister. In fact, to the tune of R1 billion. In other words, those 71 ministers are costing you, the taxpayer, R1 billion a year. That's what it costs to keep Jacob Zuma in power.
Thabo Mbeki's last cabinet was between 200 and 300 million rand a year, right, by way of comparison.
Right.
So we're looking at three times the cost.
Should there not be some sort of structure that now gets set into place where there's some sort of cap on the number of ministers that a president can put into offices? The ANC had made a statement prior to the announcement of the ministers saying that the goal was to streamline the cabinet ministers. But clearly, this move has been the complete opposite to that.
In a ruling party which is as factional as the ANC, you simply can't run with 15 ministers. There's just, you know, the handouts need to be far greater than that. It's wonderful being a cabinet minister in this country. It is probably, possibly, one of the best jobs on earth.
Mm.
You don't necessarily need to be qualified. There are systems in place that when you fall off your chair, you know, there's someone to sort of pick you up and put you back down on it.
He's not going to live that down, is he?
No, he isn't going to live that down. And at the end of the day, this is just backslapping. That's what it is. You scratch mine, I scratch yours. It's an absolutely terrible situation.
Mm. All right, gentlemen, we've run out of time. But again, thank you for coming in this afternoon. As always, enjoy our conversations for the Daily Maverick News Edition. But before I leave, do yourself a favor and subscribe to the Daily Maverick newsletter. Some really thought-provoking articles that get written by fine journalists such as Simon and Richard, who have joined me this afternoon. The Daily Maverick newsletter, make sure that you subscribe to that. And just to share a quote with you from today's newsletter, of course, another big news story that in fact broke yesterday already was the passing of Maya Angelou. And in this morning's edition of the Daily Maverick newsletter is a quote from Maya Angelou. What is a fear of living? It's being preeminently afraid of dying. It is not doing what you came here to do out of timidity and spinelessness. The antidote is to take full responsibility for yourself, for the time you take up and the space you occupy. If you don't know what you are here to do, then just do some good. I'm Mabale Moloi, and thank you for joining us here for the Daily Maverick News Edition right here on Cliff Central. I'll leave you with this tribute to Maya Angelou.
The store was my favorite place to be. Alone and empty in the mornings, it looked like an unopened present from a stranger.
Out of the huts of history, shame, up from a past that's rooted in pain. Not only words of her poetry, they might as well be lines ripped from the pages of her life story. Maya Angelou did, in fact, rise as a writer, dancer, and actress, but perhaps most significantly, as an educator. She taught the world about the power of words.
I wrote this piece for every human being on earth.
She was raised by her grandmother in Arkansas, about 25 miles away from a town called Hope.
I was terribly hurt in this town.
At 7 years old, she was raped by her mother's boyfriend. She told on him, and he was subsequently killed. The event caused her to stop speaking for 5.5 years.
I'm tossed and I'm driven long.
But once she opened her mouth, her tongue became the pen of a skillful poet. She said poetry cured her muteness. She wrote several autobiographies, short stories, and collections of poetry, including All God's Children Need Traveling Shoes, The Heart of a Woman, and I Know Why the Cage Bird Sings. In 1993, at President Bill Clinton's request, Angelou wrote a poem for his inauguration.
Lift up your eyes upon this day breaking for you. Give birth again to the dream. Women, children, men, take it into the palms of your hands.
She combined her rich tenor with her wisdom and became a sculptor of words.
I open my mouth to the Lord and I won't turn back, no. I will go. I shall go. I'll see what the end is gonna be.
Lindsay Davis, ABC News.